Southern Fried True Crime covers cases that are not suitable for young listeners, and there may also be some explicit language used. Listener discretion is advised. When a teenager kills, as a society, we are both repulsed and riveted. As parents of teens, we are even more horrified and naturally think, well, my kid would never do that. We have also come to accept that our brains are not fully developed until about age 25. Studies vary, but that seems to be the age most scientists agree on. And we've known this for decades. But in the United States, teenagers can and often are tried as adults in criminal courts. There are several deciding factors, including cognitive and moral capacity, as well as the severity of the crime. The laws also vary state to state. Today's case reminds me somewhat of the Duke murders in episode 114. The coldness, the planning, the sheer senselessness of the brutality, as well as the reason. Nathan Callahan was mad. He was mad about being grounded. He felt old enough and entitled enough to do as he pleased. But at 15 years old, was he old enough to understand? If you have hard-held beliefs about juveniles being tried as adults, this one might make you pause, or it may solidify your feelings. Welcome to episode 124, Teenage Double Murderer, Nathan Callahan. Kingsport, Tennessee is located in Sullivan County. Sullivan County was one of the earliest settled areas in Tennessee, dating back to its establishment in 1780. It's the second oldest county in Tennessee, originally established on land that would become part of North Carolina. The county was named after General John Sullivan, a New Hampshire Revolutionary War leader. But the first settlers to become permanent fixtures in the area came from Pennsylvania, some 20 years earlier. Before colonial settlers arrived on the land that would later become Sullivan County, the area had previously been inhabited by the Cherokee. But as the Revolutionary War between the colonial settlers and Great Britain raged on, the Cherokee became aligned with British forces and fought to keep the white men from their territory. Because of this, Sullivan County was home to the infamous Battle of the Island Flats in 1776, which saw the Cherokee, under the command of the war chief Dragging Canoe, lead a group of around 200 warriors to fight against the invading settlers. During the battle, members of the colonial militia groups defeated the Cherokee in a bloody fight, positioning themselves as permanent inhabitants in the region. The county served many travelers throughout the 1700s through the early 1900s, when travelers would stay in the local Deary Inn. During this period, Sullivan County was also home to many historic monuments in the state of Tennessee. In 1768, the first river port in the state was set up and named the Boatyard. In 1773, one of the first churches of any denomination in the state's history was established. The oldest wagon road in Tennessee was also created in 1776. Later, in the early 19th century, Sullivan County's economy began to grow with industries such as ironworks, powder mills, tanneries, grist mills, and sawmills that were built in the area. At the time of the Civil War, according to BlackAppalachia.org, enslaved people made up about 8% of the population in Sullivan County. Sullivan County was one of the few East Tennessee counties to support secession. It became known as the Little Confederacy. East Tennessee had shown an early anti-slavery sentiment. In fact, much of the region was Union-leaning. There is still a painful history of slavery in the area, of course, and Sullivan County went with most of Tennessee, joining the Confederacy. The Confederacy lost a major battle at Blountville in Sullivan County, and it took some 40 years for the area to recover. The Holston River provided the area with job and economic opportunities early on, especially after the river became a port that allowed access to the Tennessee River. One of the cities that makes up Sullivan County is Kingsport, Tennessee, filled with a rich history of its own. The area surrounding the Holston River which runs through the city, is referred to as the Long Island of the Holston River, and was the site of the Cherokee Sacred Council's meeting place. Now a U.S. historical landmark, the Long Island was the birthing place of treaties, meetings, and discussions between the Native Americans and early settlers. Daniel Boone's famous Wilderness Trail also began on the Long Island of the Holston River and eventually led him to the Cumberland Gap. Old Man Bishop of Kingsport was said to have invented the famous Long Island tea cocktail during Prohibition in the 1920s. The better-known origin story is that a bartender in Long Island, New York, created the recipe during a cocktail crafting competition in the 1970s. Kingsport and cocktail historians point out that we only have the word of the Long Island, New York bartender himself for the source of that story. But of course, Kingsport can't exactly prove it either, even though it has a believability factor due to the drink's disguise as a commonplace Southern beverage, sweet tea. Kingsport, Tennessee is located within the Appalachian Mountains, near the border of Virginia. Today, the city advertises as a vacation spot for its outdoor recreational activities, with its vast biking and hiking trails, fishing spots, and community events. It also includes the Daniel Boone Trail as one of the many pieces of history that visitors and locals can immerse themselves in. The city has a population of about 50,000 people, but retains the small town charm of many Appalachian cities. Kingsport is known as the Model City because it was planned, outlined, and designed by city planner and landscape architect John Nolan. The downtown area lies east of the Holston River's South Fork and today has its own selfie trail. The city itself is home to many smaller neighborhoods, one of which is the Indian Hills suburb, where in 1994, a vicious attack rattled the area and the entire state of Tennessee. On March 30, 1994, 42-year-old Gail Callahan and her 13-year-old daughter Holly woke up expecting to have a fun day. Gail's husband, Glenn Callahan, was out of town on a business trip, but he was expected to return home later that evening. Gail wanted to get out of the house, do some shopping around town, and go out to eat with her daughter. Nathan, Gail's teenage son who had recently turned 15, was home at the Callahan house as well, but there wasn't a lot of hope that he would join his mom and sister on their day out. Like a lot of angsty teenage boys, Nathan had grown distant, especially in the past few months. So Gail and Holly made their plans for the day, telling Nathan when he could probably expect them to be home before they left. No one would suspect that just hours later, a 911 call would be placed by another Kingsport mother, asking police to check on the Callahan family, worried about a phone conversation she had overheard between her son and Nathan Callahan. I'm going to pause now for a short commercial break. The Callahan family lived in a beautiful two-story upper-middle-class home with an attached garage and lots of space, nestled in the Indian Hills community. The Callahans were seemingly a normal, happy family. Gail Peters Callahan and Glenn Allen Callahan were married at the First Assembly Church of God in Kingsport in 1976. Born in April of 1951, Gail was 4 years older than her husband. She grew up in Kingsport, while he was from the nearby tiny town of Blountville. After honeymooning in Gatlinburg, the couple lived in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, before settling back in Gail's hometown of Kingsport. The population of Kingsport was smaller during the Callahans' time there. Between the late 70s and mid-90s, there were between 32,000 and 35,000 residents. Glenn Callahan owned a hair salon. Gail Callahan worked at a local pharmacy where she got to know a lot of other people in town. She was well-liked and known basically as an all-American mom. Their son, Nathan Allen, was born in early March of 1979, and his younger sister, Holly Ann, was born in September of 1980. In 1994, Nathan attended high school in the area, and Holly was a student at the local middle school. Both of the kids had many friends, and enjoyed the privileges of being in an upper-middle-class family. From the outside looking in, the Callahans didn't seem to have any big problems, but as usual, looks are deceiving. In the fall of 1993, Gail and Glenn began to worry about their son. At the age of 14, Nathan Callahan's attitude had changed, and his parents became worried about his new behavior. Nathan had started hanging out with new friends that year, and slowly, his grades began to suffer. His parents became suspicious that their son might be doing drugs with this group of friends. Like most teens in the 90s, Nathan spent a lot of time talking to his friends on the landline phone in the house, so his father decided to snoop in on his conversations to find out what was going on in his son's life. That fall, Glenn installed a recording device on their home telephone. For a few months, Glenn didn't learn anything new about his son's activities, but on New Year's Eve, he got the confirmation he and his wife had been searching for. That evening, Glenn taped a conversation between Nathan and one of his friends in which the two chatted about smoking pot. During that phone call, his dad also learned that Nathan had been sneaking out of the house at night and driving the Pontiac Trans Am his grandfather had recently bought him as a gift, despite the fact that Nathan didn't even have a driver's license yet. After listening to the recording, Glenn confronted his son. He brought up the changes in Nathan's behavior, the drug use, and the sneaking out. The 14-year-old denied all of it and refused to tell his father who he was getting the marijuana from. During the confrontation, Glenn lost his temper and smashed an electric guitar that Nathan's grandfather had bought him. After losing his temper so violently, Glenn was fearful of how his son might react. That night, he spent the evening sleeping in the finished basement of the home, the area of the house that Nathan had to himself. By the time that Nathan and Glenn woke up the following morning, things seemed to have settled down somewhat between the father and son. Nathan eventually went to the shower while his father was still downstairs, but after a while, Glenn realized that his son had been gone for a suspiciously long time. When he checked the shower, he realized that Nathan had actually crawled out the bathroom window. Glenn told Gail, and the Callahans started searching for their son, growing even more worried, considering the bad fight Glenn and Nathan had the night before. After a while, they ended up finding Nathan lying under the basement steps to the home, ignoring their calls for him. Following the taped phone call, the ugly confrontation, and Nathan's half-baked escape attempt, Glenn Callahan decided to sell his son's car as a punishment and began taking him for random drug screenings. The Callahans also stopped giving Nathan an allowance and restricted his activities outside of school. They thought they were doing what was best for Nathan, trying to keep him away from drugs and out of trouble. Nathan was also forbidden to get his learner's permit to drive until his grades improved and he passed drug screens. But these punishments infuriated Nathan. He failed all his drug tests and continued to act out. So a month later, in January of 1994, the Callahans took their son for an outpatient mental health evaluation. The doctor who evaluated Nathan determined that he wasn't suffering from any mental illness or mental disturbance. However, the evaluation results did point to continued substance abuse. The doctor recommended that Nathan receive outpatient counseling and potentially more serious treatment if his drug screens continued to come back positive. By February, things had seemed to calm down in the Callahan home. Gail traded in her vehicle for a 1994 black Camaro that month as an incentive for her son. She told Nathan that if he could pass just two drug tests in a row, the car would be his, but until then, she would be keeping the keys locked up. Nathan still repeatedly failed his drug screens. Nothing Gail and Glenn did seemed to be able to reach Nathan. Throughout these few months, Nathan's frustration and resentment toward his parents began to grow. He felt betrayed by their rules and punishments. Early in the week of March 30th, 1994, Holly was hanging out with one of her friends while her older brother was nearby. Without any context or reason, Nathan approached his sister and asked, "What would you do if I killed Mom and Dad?" Obviously, this upset Holly, and she replied, "Nathan, shut up. That's not nice to say. You shouldn't do that, and I would hate you forever if you did." Holly might have thought he was just being morbid or joking, though she clearly didn't think it was funny. But he wasn't. For about 2 weeks, Nathan had been planning to murder his family and his grandparents in retaliation. I'm going to pause now to hear a word from today's sponsors. Summer in the South can be so oppressive with the humidity and heat. The last thing I want to do is spend extra time cooking over a hot stove. But I also don't want to order takeout for every meal. That's why I'm loving Daily Harvest. Daily Harvest delivers delicious harvest bowls, flatbreads, smoothies, and more, all built on organic fruits and vegetables right to your door. It takes literally minutes to prepare, and I love knowing that the food I'm eating is actually good for me. Daily Harvest never uses preservatives, added sugar, or artificial anything. My favorite summer treat is Daily Harvest Scoops, their plant-based ice cream. Scoops is the perfect treat. It's gluten and dairy-free. My favorite is the ooey-gooey Midnight Fudge Scoops. Daily Harvest is all about leaving the earth a better place than they found it, not just for us, but for generations to come. They focus on increasing biodiversity, investing in organic farming practices, reducing food waste, and even prioritizing recyclable and compostable packaging. Daily Harvest is delicious food all built on whole organic fruits and vegetables that conveniently stays fresh in your freezer, so it's ready when you are. It really is the whole package. Stay cool, calm, and collected during the summer heat. Go to dailyharvest.com and enter code SFTC to get up to $40 off your first box. That's code SFTC for up to $40 off your first box at dailyharvest.com. dailyharvest.com. There are hundreds of companies out there claiming to compare auto and home insurance rates, but there's only one who actually does it. Get a better insurance with Gabby, and I know it because I've done it. Gabby is the one true comparison platform with fast and verifiable quotes, not just ballpark guesses. Use your current policy to find a better policy. Compare your current coverage with 40 of the top insurance providers like Progressive, Nationwide, and Travelers, all in one place. The Gabby website was so easy to use and helped me find the right policy. The Gabby representative was so friendly and helpful, and my car insurance, which includes my entire family, was almost cut in half for the same coverage I had previously. I had several quotes pop up, but the top three were the best, making it so easy to choose. Gabby customers save around $961 per year on average, and they'll never sell your info, so you won't get those annoying spam robocalls. Put your policy to the test like I did. Get a better insurance with Gabby. It's totally free to check, and there's no obligation. Go to gabby.com/sftc. That's gabi.com/sftc. gabby.com/sftc. On March 30th, as Gail happily got ready for her day out with Holly, she had no idea what her son was planning. She had invited Nathan, always hoping to engage him, but as usual, he declined. Starting early that day, Nathan called two of his friends multiple times about his plans to murder his family, not realizing, of course, that there was a recording device installed on the phone. His friends, James Saylor and Jonathan Mann, didn't seem to just humor Nathan. At least one of the friends, James Saylor, encouraged him. Nathan had several long conversations with his buddies that horrifically showcased his animosity towards his family. Saylor was the friend Nathan talked to the most that day. He told him that his mom and sister had gone out to eat, and he expected them home soon. His plan was to ambush them in the garage and then lie in wait for Glenn to arrive home from his business trip. Some of these recordings were later played in court. In one, Nathan told Saylor, "Why don't you come over? I'm going to shoot them as they walk in the door. Come up behind them and shoot them in the garage, so I don't get blood all over the house." Nathan went on, quote, "Going to wait around the corner, you know, at the garage. When they walk in, I'm going to come up behind them, then pow, pow." Then he laughed. Saylor responded, "Why don't you just push them in the garage and turn the car on?" Nathan said he thought he would be able to remain in the house for weeks after the murders, but he was worried people might grow suspicious if bills weren't paid or when his parents failed to turn up at their jobs. And yet, he remained confident in his plan, also saying he planned to kill his grandparents as well. I should add here that I never found much explanation on why Nathan included his grandparents in the planning. If anything, it sounds as though they showered their grandson with expensive gifts. It may have been because he knew they would become suspicious quickly when they didn't hear from his parents, or maybe he was mad that they didn't intervene when his parents sold his car. Sometime during this series of phone calls, Nathan began searching the home for the pistol that he planned to use in the attack. In one call, he can be heard complaining that he was unable to find the pistol and said that he would instead have to use a 20-gauge shotgun. His grandfather had bought him the shotgun as a gift, and his parents had confiscated the gun and hidden it under their bed. But of course, Nathan had found it. He told his friend that he was worried he would have trouble sneaking up on Gail and Holly with a shotgun, but planned to ambush them anyway. After stashing the shotgun near the garage, Nathan decided that it was time for another call to a friend, this time Jonathan Mann. Nathan told Jonathan, "I've got the goddamn gun and I'm looking out the blinds. As soon as I see that fucking car, I'm gonna go out there and wait for them. I'm gonna shoot them in the garage before they can get in the house." He also told Mann, "I'll go to jail if I get caught." And then he asked his friend, "How many years do you think I'd get? Life?" And Jonathan said, "Yeah, probably." Nathan then called James Saylor on a three-way line with Jonathan Mann and again explained his plan. He said, quote, "We gotta kill my grandparents tomorrow." Saylor recommended poisoning Gail Callahan's food with Valium instead of shooting her, to which Nathan responded, "No, I'm shooting her ass, bitch." Shortly after this, the black Camaro pulled into the driveway of the Callahan home. Nathan was still on the phone with James Saylor, but put the receiver down with his friend still on the line so he could hear what he was about to do. Nathan went out to the garage, got the shotgun, and waited for the garage door to open. As the door opened and Gail and Holly walked inside, Nathan shot his little sister first, and she fell to the garage floor. Then he rounded on Gail and shot his mother in the shoulder. While Holly was knelt on the garage floor, Nathan walked closer to her and shot her in the head. Then Nathan turned on his mother again, pointing the gun at her and pulling the trigger, only to find that the gun was empty. He reloaded the gun and then shot his mother in the buttocks, back, and head. Within a few sickening minutes, his ambush was complete, and Nathan returned to the phone to tell Saylor that he had just killed his mother and sister, excitedly telling his friend, "I blew their brains out." Saylor had heard the screams and gunshots during the attack, and according to the Johnson City Press, he told his mother about what had happened. Maybe he had thought this was all just shit talk and Nathan wouldn't really do it, but he was freaked now. His mother, Terrell Saylor, then dialed Nathan's line again and made her son speak to him while she listened in on the conversation. She heard Nathan say he had killed his mom and Holly. And after they hung up, Terrell Saylor immediately called 911. Meanwhile, Nathan rifled through his mother's purse for money, took her cell phone and the shotgun, got into the Camaro, and started joyriding around town. Police were dispatched to the Callahan home after Terrell Saylor's 911 call, and when they arrived on the scene, they found the garage door to be open slightly. As they walked into the garage, they were met with the disturbing and grisly scene of Gail and Holly's bodies. The officers did a sweep of the home in order to make sure Nathan Callahan was not still inside the house. During this sweep, they identified numerous bloody shoe prints within the garage and home, but found no sign of Nathan or anyone else alive. Along with the shoe prints, they began to process the scene. Officers found shell casings scattered in the garage, and Gail Callahan's purse was found sitting atop a laundry basket, where Nathan had presumably tossed it after taking the cash that was inside. Following the vicious murders of his mom and sister, Nathan wasn't just joyriding. He was looking for more friends to brag to about the murders. He ended up going to the Kingsport Fort Henry Mall, where he went inside the local video arcade. He was looking for his friend, Jonathan Mann, but didn't find him. Instead, he stumbled on another friend and classmate named Andrew Carter. Nathan bragged about killing his mother and sister, but Andrew didn't believe him. So he pulled out the keys to the Camaro and said, "Do you believe me now?" He also told Carter that he needed to find a place to hide, since he had screwed up his plan and ran from the house. But evidently, Andrew said no. After the mall, Nathan went to a gas station where he bought a pack of cigarettes and a soft drink and considered his options. A few hours had now passed, and police had received a tip from a man who saw Nathan driving around with the shotgun in his vehicle. The man followed Nathan to the convenience store and kept an eye on him until police got there. When the officers arrived, they found Nathan on the payphone. They arrested him there without any resistance. Within a total of 4 hours after Nathan had brutally murdered his mom and sister, he was apprehended by police and taken to the sheriff's department. Glenn Callahan had returned from his business trip, and after learning about the horrific loss of his wife and daughter, went to the sheriff's department to see his son. I'm going to pause now to hear a final word from today's sponsors. One Nefarious Doctor, a hit podcast, and 15 million listeners later, Dr. Death is still making waves all over the world. Dr. Death is the true story of Dr. Christopher Dunch, a sociopath with a scalpel who left a trail of bodies behind him. Before he was stopped, 33 patients would become paralyzed or die under his care. Now the phenomenon of Dr. Death is being reimagined in a new streaming series starring Alec Baldwin, Anna Sophia Robb, Joshua Jackson, and Christian Slater, exclusively on Peacock. Experience 3 brand new bonus episodes of the Dr. Death podcast, where the cast interviews the real-life characters they portray in the streaming series. Golden Globe Award winner Christian Slater sits down with Dr. Kirby, the doctor who finally took Dunch down. Anna Sophia Robb talks to Michelle Shugart, the district attorney who put him behind bars. And Dr. Death host and reporter Laura Beal speaks with the full cast about how making the show changed their perspectives on institutions and the medical system. To listen to these new bonus episodes, follow Dr. Death on Amazon Music, Apple Podcasts, or you can listen ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app. Is there something bothering you? Sometimes my anxiety can make me just freeze up. It interferes with my productivity. BetterHelp Online Counseling is there for us. They will assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist. BetterHelp has over 3,000 licensed therapists in all 50 states, treating depression, anxiety, stress, trauma, grief, and other issues that so many of us suffer from. In fact, so many people have been using BetterHelp that they are recruiting additional counselors in all 50 states. The service is also available to clients worldwide. From your phone, laptop, or tablet, you can connect with a professional counselor via text, chat, phone, or video, and start communicating with your counselor in under 24 hours. And you can send a message to your counselor at any time. You'll get timely and thoughtful responses, and you can schedule weekly sessions with your counselor by video or phone, whichever makes you feel more comfortable. BetterHelp is committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches, so it is easy and free to change counselors if you want to, and anything you share is confidential. BetterHelp is more affordable than traditional offline counseling, and there is even financial aid available. I want you to start living a happier life today. As a listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting betterhelp.com/southern. Join over 1 million people taking charge of their mental health. Again, that's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Southern. Because Nathan was only 15, the police followed protocol and waited until Glenn Callahan arrived at the station and granted them permission to question his son. Once they had Glenn's permission, the questioning process began. Nathan was advised of his Miranda rights on several occasions before and during the process. He was informed of his rights, including the Miranda warning we are all familiar with from TV. You have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can be used against you in court. You have the right to talk to a lawyer for advice before we ask you any questions and have him with you during questioning. If you cannot afford to hire a lawyer, one will be appointed before any questioning if you wish one. If you decide to stop answering questions now without a lawyer present, you can stop answering anytime you wish. Nathan stated that he understood the statement as it was read to him and signed the waiver of his rights. During questioning, the officers noted that Nathan was calm. He wasn't visibly upset. He never cried or shook or showed signs of being scared. In fact, Nathan remained polite during the entire conversation with police. It also did not appear that he was under the influence of any substances. A drug screen later confirmed that Nathan was not on any drugs, nor had he been drinking at the time he waived his right to remain silent. And he insisted to the officers that he wanted to talk to them. The officers then read the second part of the Miranda form to Nathan, which stated, "I have read this statement of my rights, and I know what my rights are. I want to make a statement and answer questions. I do not want a lawyer at this time. I understand and know what I am doing. No promises or threats have been made to me, and no pressure or force of any kind has been used against me." Nathan reread and signed the form, stating that he understood what he was signing. Then Nathan launched into a lengthy statement, which one of the officers transcribed as he spoke. He described how his parents had begun punishing him in the last year by taking away his things, keeping him away from his friends, and cutting off his allowance. Nathan explained that as his resentment grew, he began to plan the murder of his family members in order to retaliate against them. Then, he chillingly gave the officers a play-by-play of the attack on Gail and Holly. According to his statement, he had spoken to some of his friends, namely James Saylor, about his plans and how he had talked over ideas and options about the murders. Officers had already learned that a recording device had been installed on the home's phone and realized they would be able to access the recordings to compare to Nathan's version of events. Nathan also admitted to the police that although he was deeply angered by his parents, they had never been abusive and described his family members as, quote, people who try to do the right thing. He was given a bathroom break during the statement and another break to eat a snack and get a soft drink. Besides the one bathroom break, Nathan never requested another. Throughout the statement, he never requested an attorney be present or indicated that he wished to stop speaking to the police. He also never asked to see his father or other family members, choosing to speak to the police completely on his own. Once Nathan was finished giving his statement, the officer who transcribed it read it back to him. Nathan agreed that it was accurate and then signed each page of the transcribed statement. But naturally, after his first court date, Nathan and his attorney filed a motion to suppress the statement that he had given to police in the hours following the murders. His attorney asserted that while he, quote, may have understood the literal language of the Miranda warnings, the officers failed to inform him of the ramifications of his waiver. He argued that the officers should have provided him with an explanation of the judicial system and should have informed him of the possibility of being prosecuted as an adult. The motion was denied, with the judge stating that the waivers that Nathan had willingly signed were simple, straightforward, and perhaps designed to address all levels of education. They also noted that the environment in which Nathan provided his statement was calm, without pressure from the officers, and that Nathan's demeanor had been calm, and he was willing to speak with the officers. The court also stated that the officers in the room were under no obligation to tell Nathan that he might be tried as an adult, stating that a police officer could not predict the future. According to the judge, such a requirement could be dangerous because any time a police officer steps over that boundary and attempts to predict the future of a case or of a juvenile's possible incarceration, the officer runs the risk of misleading the juvenile. This bit of legal wrangling by Nathan's attorney is typical, and usually it seems like a reasonable argument. But remember, Nathan had admitted on those phone recordings that he would probably get life in prison. He seemed fully aware of the consequences of his actions, a fact that would become all too obvious in court. Nathan was initially held in the juvenile court system because of his young age, but the DA's office soon moved to try him as an adult. During a portion of his time spent in the juvenile detention center, He underwent a month-long psychological evaluation at another facility, which found that he did not have any mental illnesses that would require him to be committed or prohibit him from assisting in his own defense. Under Tennessee Code Title 37, if tried as a juvenile, the longest he could be kept in the system would be the age of 19. If tried as an adult, he would face life in prison. While we may not always agree with the decision to try juveniles as adults, you can see how a judge might make the decision to try a teen like Nathan Callahan as an adult. To think he would only spend 3 years in juvie for the premeditated murders of his mother and sister seems unconscionable, but it's the law. 2 months after the murders, at the end of June in 1994, a hearing was held to determine if Nathan would be charged with 2 counts of first-degree murder or remain in the juvenile system. During the hearing, Glenn Callahan sat at his son's side while the leading investigators in the case described the horrific scene they had walked into, the grisly finding of Gail and Holly's bodies, and then how they found the bloody footprints and scattered shell casings. They emphasized the cold and unbothered way that Nathan Callahan had delivered his confession to them back at the precinct, and spoke of how the teen had bragged to friends following the deadly ambush. Based on these accounts and Nathan Callahan's signed confession, the juvenile court judge in the case determined that Nathan would be tried as an adult. He was transferred to the Sullivan County Jail following this decision, where he would await trial. Now that he would be in an adult jail, the judge in the case arranged for Nathan to have special circumstances, including 3 meals a day, unlike the usual 2, tutoring, counseling, and a guard assigned to him for 24 hours a day. He was also kept away from the adult inmates. On March 13, 1995, just 17 days before the one-year anniversary of Gail and Holly Callahan's murders, Nathan's trial began. It would last just 5 days before a jury of 7 women and 5 men would deliver a verdict in the case. The state built their case around the abundance of evidence they had, including the tape recordings from Nathan's phone calls on the day that he attacked his mom and sister. The recordings were played for the jury, who heard how Nathan had planned the murders and debated different options with his friends. The state also maintained that Holly was not the primary target, but was killed to eliminate her as a witness, and that Nathan had willingly provided the police with a signed confession and version of the events that lined up with the phone calls, the crime scene, and his activities following the murders. The defense argued that Nathan had been pressured into committing the murders by his friend's encouragement, and that he really didn't understand the weight of his choices. A clinical psychologist, Dr. Nancy Lanthorm, testified for the defense after evaluating Nathan and the phone call recordings. She testified that Nathan was emotionally and socially immature, meaning that he was unable to evaluate and assess the consequences of his actions at the time of the murders. She argued, quote, "He was not reflecting. He was not planning realistically at that time." In response to this, the state presented the testimony of Dr. Kevin Blanton, who had evaluated Nathan during his month-long mental evaluation before being transferred to the adult jail. Dr. Blanton testified that Nathan had enough maturity in his ego development to empathize with others and think about his future actions and take responsibility for his behaviors. Overall, Dr. Blanton believed that Nathan Callahan was able and did deliberate about the killings beforehand, and that while he was nervous, he wasn't consumed by emotion in a way that would rid him of responsibility for his actions. A psychiatrist who evaluated the recordings also determined that while experiencing nervousness, Nathan's judgment did not seem to be clouded. He was determined to kill his family. After 6 hours of deliberation, the jury returned to deliver a guilty verdict. Nathan Callahan was convicted of 1 count of first-degree murder in the case of his mother, Gail, and 1 count of second-degree murder in the case of his sister, Holly. Nathan was sentenced to life in prison for the murder of his mother, with an additional 22 years added onto the sentence for the murder of Holly. Following the verdict and sentencing, there was a chance that Nathan could be kept in a facility for juveniles until he turned 18, when he would be transferred to an adult prison. The judge presiding over the case was granted the choice, but after hearing that Nathan had threatened to kill a social worker and rape staff members, he determined that Nathan should be immediately placed in an adult prison. He was transferred to the infamous Bushy Mountain State Prison. Following his conviction and sentencing, Nathan's attorneys went on to raise the same issue at the appellate level that was made before his trial began. They argued that due to his young age and the alleged lack of knowledge that he could be tried as an adult, meant that he was unable to make a knowing and intelligent decision to sign the waivers of his rights. The court again denied the motion, stating that Nathan Callahan made the free and deliberate choice to sign those waivers, and noted that Nathan did not argue at any point that his confession was coerced. In another one of his appeals, the attorneys argued that there was not sufficient evidence to convict on charges of first-degree murder in the killing of his mother, Gail Callahan. In the state of Tennessee, first-degree murder convictions require an intentional, premeditated, and deliberate killing of another, where a premeditated act means one done after the exercise of reflection and judgment. According to Tennessee code, premeditation may include instances of homicide committed by poison or by lying in wait. A deliberate act means one performed with a cool purpose. Nathan argued that he was not free from passion when he killed his mother, and that he had been in an anxious and agitated state. In this appeal, his father and grandfather testified that the phone recordings from that day didn't sound like Nathan's normal voice, and that he sounded agitated during the calls. Nathan maintained that there was no real plan or premeditation to kill his mother, and that instead, he was encouraged and spurred on by his phone call with James Saylor. In one portion of a call, Nathan and Saylor discussed Saylor coming over after the murders, but Saylor makes it a point to say that he won't come over until after the attack is finished, stating, "I thought you were going to do that first. If you'll do it, I'll come over." Nathan may have been encouraged, but there was clear evidence that the murder was premeditated. In his confession to police, Nathan admitted to thinking about the murders for 2 weeks before he actually killed his mother and sister. At the time of his statement, the then 15-year-old told police, quote, "I told my sister that I was thinking about killing our parents to see what Holly thought about it. Holly did not believe me and told me not to do it. She did not think I was serious, but I was definitely serious about killing my parents." He went on to say, quote, "I called Jonathan at his home and talked with him. We talked about killing my sister and my mother, and he did not believe me. I told him I did not like the way my sister and my mother were treating me. I had been thinking about killing my father, mother, and sister for about 2 weeks because they would never let me go out and do anything with my friends." On the phone call with Saylor, he described a step-by-step plan to ambush Gail and Holly after they returned from their shopping trip, saying on tape, quote, "If I get caught, I'll go to jail. If I get pulled over, I'm gonna have to shoot the goddamn cop. I can't outrun his fucking ass because they'll have roadblocks. I could get myself in a shitload of trouble right now. How many years do you think I'd get? Life?" Following this, when Saylor suggested poisoning Gail instead, Nathan replied, "No, I'm shooting her ass, bitch." Saylor then re-emphasized, "Poison her. That would be the best way." But Nathan said no, quote, "I have to kill her, bitch. What if she wakes up? What the fuck am I gonna say? I want to leave tonight, you sorry bitch. I'm gonna shoot her. Shut the fuck up. I'm shooting her." Between his confessions and these extremely damning recordings, Nathan Callahan's appeal was again denied. In 2019, Nathan Callahan, then 40 years old, was up for parole. The lead investigator in the case and the district attorney spoke against his potential for parole, arguing that society wouldn't be safe with Nathan Callahan as a free man. His uncle and a friend spoke on his behalf, encouraging the Tennessee Parole Board to grant his parole, but in the end, it was denied. His father had stood by him during the original trial, but he had died by the time Nathan was up for parole. Glenn Callahan died in a car accident in 1999, after 2 brief years of happiness when he remarried a woman named Donna. Nathan Callahan will be eligible for a parole hearing again in 2023 at the age of 44. The phone call recordings obviously played a huge role in the conviction of Nathan Callahan and provide a frightening look into the way he was thinking before and throughout the attack on his mother and sister. But there is something else important to consider about these conversations. I find it interesting that throughout some of these phone calls, Nathan used the phrasing "we have to" or "we will" sometimes rather than saying "I," despite the fact that neither of his friends joined him in person during the murders. Nathan speaks in the collective, as if the murders were a group effort, but neither James Saylor nor Jonathan Mann assisted him in the actual act of murdering Gail and Holly. Instead, they just gave him an ample amount of tips, suggestions, and disgusting advice without ever thinking to alert the authorities or an adult about the situation. It's almost as if Nathan diverts to the collective to make himself more confident in his actions. Or, put more plainly, he sounded like he was trying to be a badass. He sounded like he was showing off what a tough guy he was. And if anything shows his age, it is that idea. During his statement to the police, Nathan admitted that Jonathan Mann didn't believe him when he told him about his desires to kill in the weeks leading up to the murders. But from what we know from the recordings, it certainly seems as if James Saylor was aware of Nathan's intentions and actively encouraged his friend to go through with his gruesome plans. To my knowledge, no charges were ever filed against Saylor or Mann. It's possible they were charged as juveniles and the records were sealed, especially Saylor, who seems more culpable, but I'm not sure. But you've got to ask yourself what would have happened if one of Nathan Callahan's friends had told their parents or the authorities about the plans Nathan was making, the threats that he had made against his parents, little sister, and grandparents. They were teenagers too, and even Saylor might still have believed that Nathan was all talk. After all, James Saylor immediately told his mother when he heard Nathan murder Gail and Holly Callahan. Was 15-year-old Nathan Callahan's brain pumped up with the dopamine of the acceptance or admiration of his peers? Is that enough of an excuse? He had 2 weeks to think about killing his family. And while he might have been egged on by his friends, that level of premeditation and malice is hard to ignore. It's our system that needs an overhaul. There are all kinds of felonies that would get you out of juvie at 19. Killing your family in cold blood shouldn't be one of them. And that's why teens like Nathan Callahan are usually tried as adults in this country. 42-year-old Gail Callahan had a long life ahead of her to enjoy with her husband, and maybe one day with grandchildren. Holly Callahan was barely even on the cusp of adulthood. She was denied the privilege of going to high school, college, getting married, having babies of her own. Can you imagine their shock and terror when they saw Nathan holding the shotgun and then realizing they were about to die? It is a horrific way to die at the hands of someone you love. And Nathan Callahan is younger than me. He still has many parole hearings in his future. If he were to get out, he could still have a full adult life, get married, have children, do all the things he denied his younger sister, have the grandchildren his parents were denied. Is that fair? Southern Fried True Crime is produced by me, Erica Kelly. Today's episode was written and researched by myself and Hannah Newcomb. The audio is edited and mixed by Ches Gray of Gray Multimedia. Southern Fried's original music is by Rob Harrison of Gamma Radio, and the original graphic art is by Coley Horner. Thank you to Natasha Morrell for suggesting today's case. As some of you already know, Facebook shut down our lovely original fan group, but we have already started a new one. Search for Southern Fried True Crime Fans Discussion Group. We will still be worshiping our patron saint, Dolly Parton, sharing recipes, and in general, being supportive and good to each other. I still intend for it to be a safe and fun corner of Facebook, so the rule is no shitasses allowed. If you enjoyed today's show, don't forget to subscribe, and please tell a friend or rate and review on iTunes. I'm also on most large platforms like Stitcher and Spotify, as well as Stitcher Premium, where you can listen ad-free. Until next time, thanks so much for listening. Y'all take care.